Our second lesson is also from the Old Testament. It is found in Exodus 33, beginning in verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you have said to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, 'I know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, if I have found favor in your sight, show me your ways, so that I may know you and find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people." He said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." And he said to him, "If your presence will not go, do not carry us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people, unless you go with us? In this way, we shall be distinct, I and your people, from every people on the face of the earth." The Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing that you have asked. For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." Moses said, "Show me your glory, I pray." And he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you the name of the Lord, and I will be gracious to whom I will show mercy, be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one can see me and live." And the Lord continued, "See, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face you shall not be seen." Friends, the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. This sermon series has proven to be a real challenge in how do I narrow down the passages in Scripture to shelter, nurture, and spiritual fellowship. How do I narrow down all these great stories and images we have of God about this stuff? I didn't pick the one where God gathers us in like a mother hen under the wings. Great passage. I didn't pick Genesis 17 and 18 where Abraham argues on our behalf in front of God to say, "Don't destroy them." I didn't pick the one right before this in Exodus where Moses, on top of the mountain, he's getting these two stone tablets and the people down below are doing the golden calf thing, where Moses has to convince God not to destroy the people and start over again. I didn't pick the one at the end of the Gospels where Jesus says, "Forgive them, they know not what they do." I think that's one of the tricks to this great ends thing, is that these are the pieces that are inextricably linked to the gospel, that appear everywhere and often and early and late and scattered throughout. So I picked two stories I like because I get to do that. This story in Joshua, Rahab, outside of the fact it's a little bit salacious, just a little bit. So two male spies sneak into the city by night and spend the night at the prostitute's house. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, know what I mean. And they're there supposedly on business to spy out the territory, but apparently the king in Jericho has pretty good spies of his own because he knows they're there. And they come knocking on Rahab's door. So he knows not just that they're in the city, but he's pretty sure exactly where they are. And Rahab has a decision to make. The easy decision is, why, sure, the convicts are upstairs in the back bedroom. Go ahead, officer, go get them. Right? I mean, that's the easy way to tell the story, but it doesn't work as a story quite so well. Rahab says, "Oh, they're here and gone. You missed them already. Sorry." They're really up on the roof. They're hiding under stuff, under flax. They're essentially in a haystack on the roof. The part that has always fascinated me about this story is the conversation Rahab has after all of the spy scandal. It is when Rahab looks at the spies and says, "We know things about the Lord your God. And we know that the Lord your God is pretty impressive and very powerful and mighty." Think about that for a moment. We have heard that your God can turn the Red Sea into dry land ahead of you, even as you run away from an army. We have heard what your God allowed you to do in battle. And it's kind of scary. She's much more poetic than I am, but it's kind of scary, Rahab says. And so I want something from you. And this is perhaps the most honest statement somebody can make at this point. I've given you something. I want your God to give me something. You guys are familiar with the concept of bartering with God for things, right? Yes, quid pro quo. Give me a little bit of this, I get a little bit of that, let's make a deal. So, what does she ask for? Think about what she's asking for. She asks for her family to be protected in the same way she has protected God's spies. And she makes a big ask. There's only two of them. She wants her parents, herself, her brothers, her sisters, and their entire family to be safe. I mean, if you're going to ask, you might as well ask for a lot, right? Because she has seen what the Lord our God does. But she's very specific every time. It's not the Lord our God, your God. Now, we lose track of Rahab after this story. She kind of vanishes from the narrative. But I've always kind of wondered, like, if God is that powerful that you believe God could save you from an oncoming army and your entire family, let alone the people you just betrayed in the city, how would that not be the Lord your God? It's an interesting passage because of shelter, because of protection, and because it's asked to go in both directions. The unbeliever provides sanctuary and shelter for the people of God, and then asks for shelter, for sanctuary, for safety, for refuge to be provided. And in both cases, it's granted. Tricky passage, right? Guess what? We still do that stuff. We still have people come to church looking for the Lord, our God, which is not their God, because the wheels are falling off the bus. As a friend of mine describes it, it's a hair on fire situation, which is a suitably graphic, chaotic image for you. Still happens, right? Are we still willing to offer shelter? Moses, you guys know Moses, right? You've heard of him before? I know at least Tim's Sunday school class heard of him this morning, so. He has an interesting track record as a human being. He starts off as a basket case and he moves on to being a murderer. And he is never quite convinced that God is going to do this thing. He asks over and over again, how am I going to know you're with me? How are the people going to know you're with me? Who should I tell them has sent me? You just told me four verses earlier, but I'm forgetful, Moses says. And we get to this, and this is post Ten Commandments. This is getting like out there. We're like pushing. We're in the wilderness. He's dealt with this troublesome, quarrelsome, contrary people for a while now. You don't know anybody like that, right? And he is still asking God, give us a sign. How am I going to know you're with us? How are the people going to know you're still with me? How are the other tribes, the other nations, the other peoples out there in the world going to know we are special, that you're with us, that you love us? Well, flashback to Judges, which is actually flashing forward. The people know. Rahab already knows, right? It's Moses who doesn't get it. And so Moses says, and you would think, again, you would think that Moses would know better. Angel of the Lord, burning bush, mountaintop clouded in fire, pillar of fire, cloud of smoke. Never actually seen this God character, like in a human type form. But Moses wants to make the ask again. He's teaching Rahab something. He's going for the big ask. Show me what you've got, God. I mean, when you ask to see the glory of God, you're essentially saying, okay, God, put your cards on the table and show me what you've got. And God essentially channels a few good men and says, you can't handle what I've got, Moses. Says, you can't see the glory of God. You can't see the glory of God and survive. Wednesday morning, people think about the connection with that and what the serpent says and what God says to Adam and Eve about when you know this, you will die. Just think about that. Let that percolate. God says, but I've got a plan. I'm going to pass by, and there's this rock, and there's a cleft in it, and I'm going to put you in the rock, and you can sort of see like when my glowy presence comes by, and that's going to have to be good enough for you, Moses, because frankly, I'm going to kind of put my hand over it so you don't get too much. God is, at God's very best there, protecting us from ourselves. And sometimes that's what we have to do for one another too, isn't it? When we're sheltering one another, we protect us from ourselves. We let us tell different stories than the absolutely 100% factual story. Because sometimes to confront the facts is dangerous and hurts. We do tell the kids to stop running through the fellowship hall, don't we? Because when it's full of people on Sunday afternoon is very different from when they're all as relatively as agile as the kids on Wednesday afternoon at Sharks. I think that's a piece of shelter we need to think about, is that we intentionally shelter ourselves and one another from the power of the gospel. Do you guys remember getting a story Bible at some point, or buying a story Bible for your kids or grandkids? You know, they tell the story completely differently in those things. Jonah's completely done after the whale pukes him up on the ocean, on the seashore, and he just goes to town and ends happily ever after. Is that how the story ends? I think we didn't want the example of a prophetic temper tantrum in our children's Bibles, but there's one in there. That all brings us around to nurture in spiritual fellowship. How do you nurture someone or something? What's the biggest ingredient in nurture? Presence, love. I was thinking time. Right? Have any of you figured out a shortcut on time? Yeah, the shortcuts do end up longer or as the scenic route sometimes, don't they? How many geezer miles does a shortcut turn into? If there are no shortcuts on nourish, on nurture, how long does it take? Right, takes as long as it takes. Takes 40 years in the wilderness with the Hebrews. Takes 101 years in Sunday school with Vivian. She'll be back next week. Spiritual fellowship. That is not just eating in the other room, by the way. How do we do that? How do we talk about what moves our spirit and share that with one another? Listen to Rahab for a moment. I know what the Lord your God does. The Lord your God made there be dry land ahead of you as you walked through the Red Sea coming out of Egypt. Well, how does she know that? It was not on Facebook. It was not on CNN. And it was not in the Marion No Longer Daily Republican. How does Rahab know that? She has customers, right? And customers bring news. Customers talk, word of mouth. What happens if we're not talking about the wonderful things our God does? It's a little easier to practice with people who believe that your wonderful God does wonderful things, right? I mean, we know that God does all sorts of really weird things. Witness Moses, prophetic leader and visionary, lawgiver. He's a murderer. He's a fugitive on the lam when he gets married, when he gets called, when he gets sent back to Egypt. He's the guy that God is going to give the law to. Process that for a moment, would you? Tell the stories. Tell them to each other. Tell them so they circulate. Tell them so that, you know, they can go to the customers, so they can get over the wall to Rahab. Bob, I'm not encouraging you to be a customer. Tell these stories, because when we tell these stories, they are nurture. Right? How do you learn these stories if nobody's going to tell them to you? They are shelter. How many of you have a favorite Bible passage you go to when the chips are down? How many of you have more than one? They are shelter. And the way we tell this story together is spiritual fellowship. We tell it in a lot of different ways. We tell it in this church. We tell it through the Ministerial Alliance. We tell it through Marion Medical Mission. We tell it through Lighthouse Shelter. We tell it through Habitat for Humanity. We tell it through providing shelter for 4-H and Paradise Alley players and Art Starts over the years and a ton of other groups. We tell it because, yeah, we eat really well around here. We tell it in thousands of little stories about one another. We tell it in health ministry and parish nursing. We tell it because we have had members and pastors who are, quote, opinionated but lovable. I do listen, Dan. And somehow all of those stories, all of those things we live out, do something different. Our mission statement talks about being a missional church with mission on 4 continents. There's only 7, and Antarctica is really, really difficult. Right? Really, really difficult. So we need to get Australia and South America, and we're basically done. Who's stepping up? Those are not just words. Those are the lives of people who have spent time in this place, who have been nurtured by this place, sheltered by this place, and sent by this place. And we're not saying 1200 South Carbon and the 5 acres. We're saying the people gathered here over many, many years. When we talk about the great ends of the church, it should be hard to narrow them down because we should have an abundance, and we do. Tell those stories so we do not ever think we only do one thing faithfully. And to God alone be the glory this day and forevermore. Amen.